The German Democratic Republic, or East Germany, had a rough start. The devastation of the war, the Allied occupation, an abrupt and idealistic turn towards socialism. Despite all this, the GDR became the most important economy in the Soviet sphere, the crown jewel of Comic-Con. In this video, we look at the rise and peak of the East German economy. This video is brought to you by the Asianometry Patreon. Early access members get to see new videos first and selected references for those videos. Early access really helps me a lot, and I appreciate every pledge. Really thank you, and on with the show. Let us begin with the beginning. After the war, the German Third Reich's eastern regions of Silesia and East Prussia were ceded to Poland and the Soviet Union. Thus, the Soviet occupation zone and the GDR actually covered what had been the Third Reich's central regions. Some parts of this area were quite industrialized, and in some cases, even technologically advanced. For instance, the city of Berlin. While the areas surrounding the city were quite rural, the GDR had much of Berlin's industrial structures, including 80% of the country's office machinery and tool industries. South of Berlin, the GDR also had a significant industrial cluster. This was especially the case in chemicals. One of the world's biggest chemical plants, Luna Werke, was in the GDR. This chemical plant and others near it would become the GDR's industrial heart, producing plentiful amounts of fertilizers, dyes, synthetic rubber, and more. And near this chemical cluster was the city of Jena, and the East German half of its world-class company Carl Zeiss. Despite major losses in personnel and equipment, Zeiss remained a formidable player in optics. Germany's other major company, Siemens, was largely relocated out of Berlin to Munich by its top managers. One major issue, however, was that there was no easy access to the energy and raw goods needed to run this industrial juggernaut. The country had no oil, some coal, and uranium. But the Soviets claimed that uranium for their own nuclear programs, selling the excess back to the GDR, and the coal was not particularly high quality, generating little heat and a lot of pollution. Measured by gross value of equipment, East Germany actually had more equipment in 1944 than they did in 1936. This was because of massive infrastructure buildup during the war, as well as the fact that fighting on the ground and Allied bombing had not been so intense in East German lands. But much of this equipment was hauled off as war booty. Both sides practiced dismantling and deindustrialization policies after their victory, but the Soviets far more fervently. Its actual intensity remains debated, but estimates generally say about 30% of the capital stock was taken back to the Soviet Union. Some industries had it harder. For example, machine tools lost over 50%, optics 65%, and electrical 60%. This massive technological transfer played a critical role in the development of Soviet technology. The Soviet officers chose advanced technologies, dismantled them well, and put them to good use once back home in the Soviet Union. The Soviets also took home human capital in a secret operation. The Soviets ended up recruiting, quote-unquote, over 3,000 specialists, scientists, technicians, assistants, plus their families, across a broad range of technologies. And on top of all that, there were reparations. Until 1953, East Germany had to pay up to 15% of their total gross national income to the Soviet Union as reparations. Contrast this with the Marshall Plan, which poured hundreds of millions of dollars to rebuild West Germany, and you can see how the two countries immediately diverged. The Germany during the war had run its war economy using forced labor. Those laborers left after the war ended. Refugees and returning German soldiers helped make up some of the labor gap, but shortages persisted, especially in food. In the first 2 years after the war's end, average daily caloric intake for manual laborers was just 65% of the recommended daily total. Absentee rates were over 20% because workers often left to forage for food. East Germans started moving west. This brain drain only intensified when they heard of the 3,000 workers taken away by the Soviets. Educated workers only made up a minority of the migrants moving to West Germany. Most of them were farmers or laborers, but educated workers were more likely to stay in West Germany and not come back. This worsened a core problem with the East German economy, a struggle to rebuild technological competences. By the end of the war, The Reich was already very behind in the rest of the world in terms of technological innovation. And that was before the brain drain and the Soviet appropriations of equipment. Moreover, there was a dearth of funding for R&D and sciences, plus many of the universities and corporate R&D locations were in West Germany. All this translates to a technological lag that would persist throughout the GDR's history and keep its workers from being more productive. At the start, the Soviets and their German Communist Party partners, the SED, did not have an overarching plan for the country. However, they did agree that changes were necessary to prevent a return of German militarism. The existing structure of elites needed to be torn down and rebuilt. So they embarked on a series of land reforms, confiscating land from the big landowners and redistributing small plots to new farmers. The new owners can keep that land so long as they worked it. Such land reforms usually do quite well, but out in the fields, the new farmers suffered from inexperience, labor shortages, corruption, and missing equipment taken away by the Soviets. At the same time, the SED started pressuring all the remaining farmers to join massive collective farms, LPGs. In an LPG, land, tools, and even animals are shared amongst the group, overseen by a party official. As you might guess, this was not too popular. Tensions between the farmers and the political class in Berlin simmered for many years. The Soviets also nationalized some of the country's biggest factories and businesses, creating Soviet joint stock companies. A third of the country's industrial output became the direct owned property of the Soviet Union. It was only because of this that the dismantling of factories and industrial sites finally stopped. The Soviets apparently thought it'd be more profitable to leave them as they were. The end of the Berlin blockade and airlift solidified the divisions between East and West. With that, the West and East German republics were officially founded, recognized by their respective allies. Shortly thereafter, the ruling communist SED Party and its first secretary Walter Ulbricht set ambitious economic goals to vastly increase output and accelerate socialism. This was partly to generate enough wealth and output to pay the Soviets their onerous reparations, but also because the party recognized that the presence of West Germany fundamentally challenged their own legitimacy to rule. Plans towards socialism had to be accelerated. The SED's economic strategy felt distinctly Asian. The government would suppress capital for personal consumption and instead funnel that into investment, building new factories, roads, and infrastructure. This meant rationing goods like linens, meat, sugar, electricity, and so on. In 1952, personal consumption in the GDR was just 44% of national income. In West Germany, that was 58%. But the economy struggled, in part due to the aforementioned low labor productivity. So the SED passed Order 234. Its goal was to raise productivity by getting people to work harder. There were some carrots, a hot lunch and shoes, for instance, and some sticks, withdrawal of ration cards, and deployment to a bomb-clearing site, for instance. But what irritated the workers the most was the return of piecework wages and punch clocks, something supposedly banished to the capitalist past. So imagine the situation for the ordinary East German worker. Rationing for all the things they need, including food. Shortages led to food riots in the autumn of 1952 in Leipzig and Dresden. A longer and harder work week for wages that were not always paid on time, and the inability to complain about any of this due to withdrawals in civil liberties. Meanwhile, East Berliners can easily stroll into West Berlin at the time. There you can see TVs and record players in the shops and West Germans getting richer, in part thanks to the boom of the Korean War. How can the people accept communist rule when its deficiencies are so starkly clear? The number of East Germans fleeing the country surged from 166,000 in 1951 to 182,000 in 1952. The SED only pushed harder on the country's Sovietization, collectivizing more agriculture and nationalizing more industry. The GDR also instituted military service for all men between ages of 18 and 24. The GDR did ask the Soviets for economic aid, but the Soviets had many mouths to feed. It was not just East Germany in a terrible state. Many other Soviet satellite countries were suffering too. For example, Hungary, where the Hungarian Communist Party leader Matyas Rákosi was pushing through an irresponsible Stalinization program that emphasized steel plants over food and caused 1 million people to be persecuted. Then, Stalin died. As a power struggle played out in the Soviet Union, the Communist Party sent someone to review the situation in April 1953. To their horror, they found that nearly 500,000 East Germans had already fled to the West. Furthermore, this included nearly 3,000 SED Party members in the first few months of 1953. When even the party members are leaving, you know it is bad. Lavrenty Beria, the former head of the NKVD and the Soviet leader after Stalin's death, pinned blame on Ulbricht and his rapid industrialization policies. Beria pushed for reforms, including Ulbricht's removal and a possible reunified Germany. A new course was publicly announced in March 1953, revoking price increases and granting leniency for returnees, among other concessions. This did help, but importantly, it did not touch the productivity quotas that so irked the workers. A few months later, we have the uprising. The East German uprising of 1953 began on June 16, 1953. It started as a purely local dispute that quickly spread. A simple sit-down strike by workers at a socialist boulevard called the Stalin Alley. The workers were striking against increases in work hours and quotas. The strikers then took to marching, and it gathered other industrial workers like tax collectors and garbage men, even policemen and a few SED party members. The march arrived at the House of Ministries and demanded to speak to Ulbricht. He did not show up, but several lesser officials did, pledging to roll back the hikes. The crowd refused to accept. Simple demands for better quotas, wages, and work hours mushroomed into general ones like food shortages, freedom, democratic elections, and German reunification. The workers now agitated for a general strike. The word spread, asking workers in some 272 other towns to strike in solidarity with those in Berlin. Alarmed, the SED senior leadership sought refuge in the Soviet military headquarters. On the 17th of June, the Soviets declared martial law, sending troops and tanks to disperse the crowds. At least several dozens of people died. Strike leaders in several cities were arrested and executed without trial. Nevertheless, the demonstrations lasted for several more days, finally dying down by June 24th. The East German uprising of 1953 taught the SED some lasting lessons. From now on, the SED would always keep a close eye on the workers on the shop floor. This included increased surveillance and combat groups to respond to discontent before it could mushroom into something bigger. This, in turn, led to the strengthening of the infamous East German internal police, the Stasi. The uprising also set the precedent that the Soviets would militarily intervene in their satellites' affairs to keep their governments in line. But along with the stick came a few carrots. The Soviets terminated the reparations payments that so burdened the East Germans, and they also gifted, quote-unquote, back all of their joint stock companies except the one overseeing the uranium mine. Behind the scenes, the Soviets made it clear to the SED and Walter Ulbricht that the pace had to slow down. Things did slow down a bit, but the socialist economic policy remained. And despite the Soviets' own attempts to find a suitable replacement, Ulbricht himself remained in charge. And finally, for the East German workers who protested, they came to the realization that they had no voice in this country. And so even more people decided to vote the only way they could, by leaving. Things improved a bit, but in 1956 came the Hungarian Revolution, another uprising violently put down by the Soviets. Ulbricht took advantage of the revolution as the impetus to paint several moderate members and critics of his rule as revisionists. Those people were purged from the party, securing Ulbricht's rule for a decade. Revitalized, the SED hardliners, tired of slow progress towards socialism and the country's ongoing economic struggles, felt the need to show the, quote, superiority of the socialist world order over the capitalist system, end quote. So in 1959, they replaced the existing economic plan and unveiled a new 7-year plan. It called for ambitious raises in industrial productivity. Iron and coal labor productivity was to rise by 90%, and machine building productivity by 160%. Overall, labor productivity had to be nearly doubled, again through the raising of work norms and automation technology. Formerly private, independent craft businesses had new taxes and regulations levied to force them to join massive artisan collectives. Out in the fields, the ongoing collectivization of agriculture, at the time slow but steady, would be accelerated. This was done using agitation troops deployed to pressure the farmers. Stubborn farmers were dragged into court and had their possessions taken and their bank accounts blocked. Anyone could have expected that these policies would cause backlash, especially to collectivization drive, which was first implemented in February 1960 with no thought about the effects on the growing season. A new wave of labor and goods shortages hit the economy. Food rationing was reimposed later in 1960. East Germany was the only communist country with rationing, other than Albania, and we all know what's going on there. As we approach the end of the 1950s, the GDR's exit crisis worsened. By 1960, the number of migrant exits rose again for the first time since 1956 and kept rising. In the first 6 months of 1960, an average of 14,751 people left each month. That went to 18,447 in the next 6 months of 1960. And then that rose to over 19,000 in the first half of 1961. Tightening restrictions only caused more people to leave, as they correctly felt like the window was closing. This eventually led to the Second Berlin Crisis. In June 1961, Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev demanded that the United States pull out of West Berlin. Tensions between the two superpowers ramped up to new levels. There were no breakthroughs, so in August 1961, Walter Ulbricht decided to build the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall stood as a symbol of the GDR's lack of freedoms, but nevertheless, it succeeded in cutting the flow of migrants to the West, and it also showed the people that the SED was here to stay. The Berlin Wall stabilized the GDR. But the SED still had to figure out a way to generate economic growth. In the early 1960s, they tried to turn to the Soviet Union, deepening their economic cooperation. The East Germans turned the Soviets as a source of new technologies. Second, and just as importantly, the Soviets agreed to provide the East Germans with the energy they desperately needed, including promises of an oil pipeline. But having the Soviet Union as your most important economic partner is a double-edged sword. The Soviets struggled to find enough oil for all their commitments, remaining elusive on timelines when the oil would actually come. And in the late 1950s, the Soviets decided to pivot away from long-range bombers and focused on missiles instead. This had a massive impact on the aviation industries in both the Soviet Union and the GDR. Germany once had one of the most advanced aviation industries in the world. The SED had invested a lot to bring it back to its former glory. They needed the Soviets to buy at least a few of them, and the Soviets had promised to do so. But the Soviets going back on that promise, combined with the disastrous crash of one of their first prototype Bade 152 airliners, led the East German government to dissolve its national aeronautical industry. A costly loss. With the Soviets an unsteady partner, and the rest of Comic-Con unable to meet their needs, the SED decided to try something new. In 1963, the GDR announced new reforms, the New Economic System, or NES. Inspired by the ideas of F.C. Lieberman, the NES sought to devolve more control of the economy to the party's lower levels. Individual administrations, called VVVs, were allowed to allocate resources at their own behest. They were also allowed the use of incentives and bonuses. And interestingly enough, profits were allowed as a measure of success. At the same time, Ulbricht promoted science and automation as ways to overcome the GDR's persistent labor productivity issues, focusing on optics, petrochemicals, machines, and electronics. SED hardliners attacked these reforms for straying close to capitalism. They were concerned that decentralizing economic power would inevitably lead to the loss of political control, so the NEC deliberately pulled back in some ways. It did not loosen prices and did not totally set aside centralized planning. But nevertheless, for a few years, the reforms seemed to have brought about real economic change. After 6 years of debt and deficits, the East German economy turned a surplus in 1963. From 1964 to 1968, the GDR grew by about 5% each year when judged by net output. This was in part due to the NES's loosening reforms, but also due to the completion of several high-technology projects. The GDR's chemical industry had started to master plastics making. Despite persistent oil supply issues, outputs of raw plastics like polyvinyl chloride or PVC grew by over 12% each year, doubling between 1960 and 1966. This in turn generated benefits downstream at the consumer goods level. Plastics like PVC became an easy replacement for traditional things like metal or wood. And semiconductor and electronics production began picking up in a real way. Semiconductor production quadrupled from 1965 to 1969. In 1968, over 60% of households had a TV. And in 1968, the GDR completed its first atomic power station in Rheinsberg. These were the GDR's best years, economically. East Germany still lagged its Western counterpart in all of these aspects, but it seemed like they were catching up. In the second half of the 1960s, the cooperation between the GDR and the USSR began to wane. The Soviets locked down on transfers of computer technology on national security grounds. Ongoing issues like the Cuban Revolution caused them to renege on deliveries of several key supplies like oil, steel, meat, and grain. The NES's apparent success caused other Eastern European countries to experiment with these reforms too. However, they could not thread the needle of loosening economic control without losing political control as well. In 1968, the Soviets led another military intervention into Czechoslovakia to crack down on reforms that had, in their opinion, gone too far. This tainted the NES's political associations. So when the GDR economy ran into challenges in 1969 due to overinvestment and drought from bad weather, the SED entirely discarded the NES reforms and reimposed control over the economy. The party also elected a new leader. In 1971, the wily but aging Ulbricht was removed by his most powerful colleague and lieutenant, Erich Honecker. Ulbricht died 2 years later after suffering a stroke. His legacy is mixed. On one hand, he lacked imagination, and his leadership saw repeated fumbles in economic management. Nevertheless, East Germany in 1970 was the Soviet Union's leading trade partner and the most advanced economy in Comecon. East Germany's rise as an economic power within the Comecon bloc is tied to several factors. At the heart of it, the GDR was an industrial economy that took in raw goods from the Soviets and other states and processed them into refined goods using cheap energy. The country could never do that processing as well as the West could, due to issues in labor productivity and technological sophistication, but it did far better than any other Eastern state. However, the coming decades would expose that model's economic flaws. What happens when the raw goods and the energy stop becoming as cheap? More importantly, there were other unresolved issues. The GDR was too small. Its rulers were trying to impose socialism on where it had not been wanted, and its ruling party did not want to give up political control, even as it needed to give it up economically. These contradictions caused devastating crises in 1953 and 1958, and as East Germany embarked on the years of its decline and fall, those issues would rise up again and again. Alright everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to the channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.